Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Perfect love casts out fear. And so if it's fear that's keeping you from asking questions, that to me is, like I said in my book, the kind of doubt that leads to despair is not, it doesn't start when you begin asking God questions, but when out of fear you stop asking questions.
As soon as she got off stage, I went up to her and I was like, these are the first words I said to Rachel Held Evans. I said, girl, you're smart as That's the first thing I said to her.
I think the key for her was she was always willing to speak into evangelicalism and try to speak to those people in a respectful way that other commentators were not willing to do.
It was incredible that so much brain and so much heart got to be in one person. You know, a lot of people are kind of more one than the other, but she wasn't.
About every 500 years, the Latinized culture, it goes through a huge upheaval, and we're going through one right now. Every time that happens, whatever form of Christianity has to drop back and reconfigure, it doesn't ever cease to be.
They had a deep suspicion of hierarchy and institutionalism.
If fear is the motivation behind not dealing with those sort of in the back of your mind questions, that to me is the worst kind of faith of all. It's despair.
Welcome to Emerged, a story of young leaders who had audacious dreams, who became loyal friends, who achieved fame and influence, who burned brightly, but briefly. And now for the first time, many of the leaders reflect on their participation in the emerging church movement, and they consider the movement's legacy. Join us as we tell the tale of their successes and failures, the attacks they endured, the mistakes they made, what they left undone, and what they accomplished. Join us to hear the story of what emerged. And now, here are your hosts, Tony Jones and Trip Fuller, with producer Josh Gilbert.
I wanna find my way back home. I wanna learn to love, and I want to be.
Welcome back to Emerge, the podcast where we are tracking an oral history of the emerging church movement. And before we even launch too far into our intro, we want to thank our producers. We had two more producers join the crew of producers. So, Trip, let's thank them.
All right. Big shout outs to the Open Table Fellowship, Karen Sloan, Chris Estes, and Brad Cecil. That's what I'm talking about. Four producers. That's more than a trinity.
Thank you, producers. Fantastic. We couldn't do it without you. And thanks to everybody who's joined Emerged and been part of this journey with us. Speaking of a journey, you guys ready to get in a theological time machine? This is a little bit different of an episode because what we have is archival audio of Trip talking with Rachel Held Evans in 2011. For those who don't know, and I can't imagine there's anyone listening who doesn't, Rachel sadly died in 2019, way too young at age 37, and is a missing voice on the landscape. We're actually going to talk about that with Ryan Burge in the second half of the show. But the first half of the show are these conversations, Trip, that you had with Rachel in 2011 while she was actually writing her best-selling book, The Year of Biblical Womanhood. Give us the context for these conversations.
I met Rachel for the first time at the very first Big Tent Christianity event. This project me and Philip Clayton and Brian McLaren worked on, attempting, believe it or not, this is how you know we've been in a time machine. We had the naive assumption that you could get Christians across the whole spectrum together and, you know, in a big tent. And at the very first one, Rachel's first book had come out and she wanted to come and have a table and just connect with people. And Mike Morrell had said, it's really good. You want her to come. And then by the time we got to the second one, her blog had taken off. And now she's sitting on stage next to Marcus Borg talking at the Big Tent Christianity gathering in Phoenix, which at the end of the episode, when we hear from Nadia, that's the event where they first met. We had kind of connected in that process, and she was like, well, I'd be interested in doing something on podcasting and things. I said, well, let's try doing it together. So we recorded three episodes, and we called them RAT, Rachel and Tripp Talking, you know, in honor of that most epic of 80s bands. It was a fun experiment, and like she was being very biblical, Tony. In one of the episodes, she was in a tent with her head covered on Zoom recording the RAT episode.
This shows you how far back in time it was. I don't think you guys were on Zoom. I think you were on Skype.
Oh, yeah.
Remember you had to get like the add-on Skype recorder? And here's the other funny thing in listening to the full episodes, which we've edited down for this, but you two were trying to keep the episodes to 10 minutes or less because that was the maximum time allowed on a YouTube upload in 2011 was 10 minutes max. So, I mean,
we failed.
It's crazy.
Yeah, you did fail. And you were 0-for-3 in that. Well, there are such sweet conversations, and we'll get in a second to the content of them. But Josh, as a younger dude in the evangelical church at the time, where were you in 2011, and what do you remember about Rachel?
Yeah, Rachel played somewhat of a significant role in my whole process as I was traveling, touring in my band. One thing I definitely wanted to mention, though, was the word anxiety is the biggest word I think of when going through this, because at the time, 98% of my community, of my close friends, really of almost all the people I interacted with were Christian. And so it's simple, but just asking these questions was hard. It was scary. And if I think about someone who acted as a bridge that was willing to ask those questions, Rachel was the safest voice when I think of voices at that time, not only just to bring up the questions and to go there intellectually and theologically, but the way that she talked about things. I remember so well her talking about the Eucharist and motivating that everyone was allowed at the table, even in doubt, even in full dissection, even in like maybe atheism, there was a spot for people. And she really brought that together theologically in a way that I could tell my parents about it, that I could tell close ones to me. It was okay to ask these types of questions. And Rachel really was the reason I felt comfortable asking those questions.
That's an interesting reflection because, Tripp, the one thing I think about Rachel is, and even listening to these conversations you had with her, she was a non-anxious presence. Even though you can hear her really struggling, particularly with the issue of how gay persons fit in the church. Like, this is the crux of a lot of what you two talk about. And she's in some ways torn, you know, of which way she's going to go on this in 2011. You guys talk about what was happening at Sojourners, where they had rejected an ad by a gay affirming group of clergy. And this is the same year that Joe Biden like jumped the gun on President Obama and like came out on Meet the Press as a for gay marriage, and that was a big political kerfuffle that people may remember. So it's right in the thick of that. And yet, Rachel, this is the thing about her. There's no angst in her voice. She's like almost giggly. She's so sweet, but she had that non-anxious presence, I guess, which is one of the things that we all so valued about her.
That moment in time, right? This is after Prop 8 in California, and I'm working at a church that was very much open and affirming and things. And she's clearly wrestling with the question, not so much, I think, personally as like what it means in for the life of a lot of evangelical Christians that are just trying to find a way to stay in relationship and in community with people who don't know what they're thinking or are very clear in the negative. And that kind of like existential element of it was palpable. But at the macro, Tony, at this time, you and I are sending invitations to people. I mean, even people, let's say, that publish books in emergent related book series, who after you published your book around same-sex marriage and that you're not getting a legal marriage or performing any, right, until everyone has the same rights at the state and were more forward in the public square around it, you know, after that, you get this intensity of people trying to decide, like, am I distancing myself from the emerging church movement? Like, do we need to invent another collective over here where we remain ambiguous or go conservative? I remember, like, mentioning the Big Tent, one of the people who, you know, 2 years ago made a huge ordeal about how welcoming they are online with their tenured academic status at an evangelical school, sent a very long patronizing email to me when I had invited them to Big Tent Christianity, saying they had more in common with what's going on in Rome than in the emerging church these days. As someone who was involved in that kind of organizational space where you're hearing the anxieties of leaders who are in the kind of relationships Rachel is, most of them were not as gracious as her and didn't quite know what to make of people who this was no longer an issue, silence was permissible.
Yeah, and we should, I mean, you bring up the emerging church. This is obviously a podcast called Emerged, and so the question may come to people's mind, was Rachel Held Evans emergent? Was she in the emerging church movement? I mean, in some ways, Rachel, like some other figures, probably Rob Bell, Nadia Boltz-Weber, Brian McLaren, they eclipsed the emerging church movement. They kind of outlasted it, and their footprint was maybe even bigger, you know. But for sure, Rachel was at least emergent adjacent. We were all friends. We spoke at each other's events. We endorsed each other's books. You know, we were on the same team, I guess. And so that's why I think listening to this conversation you had in 2011 with Rachel is just so enlightening, especially for those maybe who are a little younger and weren't in the thick of the movement in 2011. But for those of us who were, this conversation, I think you will go right back there and you'll think, holy smokes, have things ever changed? And that's why we're definitely, you should stay tuned for the second half of the episode, because Ryan Burge helps us put some context around that.
Yeah, and at the end of the episode, we hear from Nadia about meeting Rachel for the first time at Big Tent Christianity, their friendship, their relationship, and partnership over time, and what it was like losing a close friend like Rachel so early. Before we get to those kind of reflections, we're going to hop in the theological time machine to 2011 using this thing called Skype and a really fun app called Call Recorder as Rachel and I attempt to talk for under 10 minutes a number of times for our future podcast that never released, which, you know, here you go. And this is a good reason to become a member of the Emerge community, because you'll be able to hear all the unreleased episodes of Rat, Rachel and Tripp Talking.
All righty. We're having a little, an interweb experiment, and I've decided I'm calling it Rat, with two T's, like the 80s metal band. Rachel and Tripp Talking. What do you think?
I think that's great. I like Rat.
All right. We're going to get our Rat on.
Or Tar, if you do Tripp and Rachel.
Yeah.
Well, actually, and I was going to ask you a question. A lot of times when I'm talking to people about this, I try and say something like, well, remember how Marcus Borg at Big Tent said, it's not that for God so loved the world, he sent a book. It's for God so loved the world, he sent his son. Yeah, yeah. Well, most of the time people will say to me, but everything we know about Jesus, we know from the Bible. So obviously, that's the starting point. Would you respond to that? Because I never really know exactly how to navigate that.
And I think this is important. There's a difference between the New Testament being the place in which we ground the testimony we make about the God revealed in Christ and making it hold the authority and space for the God revealed in Christ. Well, you hung out with us at Big Tent. You could probably see it. Like if you
it was so said, weird being in that environment where it's like, oh, wow, I'm like the conservative. This is weird.
I know. Now, everyone that thinks that Rachel's crazy. Right. No, I read reviews of an event where they were worried that we had a fundamentalist in our midst.
Right.
So I'm interested in you, like in those experiences outside of your normal ground. How do these kind of topics that are so divisive in different ways feel the moment you're in a room full of mainline Protestants or more progressive emergents and things?
Yeah, like on the one hand, it's so encouraging because it's like, oh, I'm not crazy for, you know, asking certain questions, for, you know, reading what I read. And, you know, and then on the other hand, it's like you guys, I say you, but, you know, the sort of mainliners, they have their own little quirks, you know, like arguing over metaphors, like, well, if we use a big tent metaphor, is that fair? Because the tent has edges. And I just want to be like, really? Are you serious? Like, it's a metaphor. It's imperfect. Like, sort of like this desperate need to include everybody. It's precious and it's encouraging because I don't always hear that here, but it's also kind of funny and strange to me. So, and very different than what I'm used to. So you guys, you know, you have your quirks, just like, you know, folks here in Dayton have theirs. And I like being a part of both conversations because I feel like I can bring a little something to both. We haven't come up with our seventh S yet.
Oh, we haven't.
Sacraments. Wait.
Sacraments.
Does that fit, though? Sex?
No, but there are seven sacraments, and it would be the seventh S.
I think that is meaningful enough to include it. So we know what the title of this thing will be. Okay, wait. Sex, science, salvation, scripture, sacraments. Wait, what were the other two S's?
Slippery slope.
Slippery slope.
On the interwebs, there's been a little ruckus about Sojourners, the magazine and group run by Jim Wallace and company, not posting an ad by the Believe Out Loud group. And have you seen that running around the interwebs?
Yes. I mean, I just saw a bunch of my favorite. It was kind of sad because I saw all my favorite liberal friends mad at each other. And they're not usually mad at each other. But there was some hostility. Yeah. But I read the blogs, but I was a little unclear about what the ad exactly was. But you clarified that. So, yeah, I did catch wind of that from my little corner in East Tennessee.
Yeah, I guess you don't have a whole lot of ministers that have joined Believe Out Loud.
Not a lot.
So that everyone knows that they are open and affirming.
Right. And how big a group are they? I mean, how many people are we talking about? Like,
I don't know. I mean, I guess I've been involved in Progressive Christians Uniting and all sorts of things like that. So
it could be five people. It could be 500. You don't really know.
Yeah, you don't know. I mean, I Believe Out Loud's a pretty big group, and they have done, like, professional video stuff and an online campaign and things. But, you know, running in UCC circles and at Claremont, it's not odd to find people who believe out loud about being open and affirming and stuff.
So were you angry, or were you – do you think it's an overreaction? Yeah, well, what's your –
You know what's funny? So I was talking to one of my youth on a retreat, and I was gone that whole time, so I didn't get to write some, like, blog posts and join the mayhem. But
which might be good. Sometimes that – well, I'm just saying sometimes that first reaction to something is, like, not always your best writing. Not you personally. I mean this in a general way. Like, if I have a few days to think about it, it's generally a little better than my first sort of response to something.
Yeah. But I was
– a failed insult. It's a good thing you waited.
Okay. But I guess for me, one of the things that came up is I'm a Believe Out Louder. There's not a a questioning bone in my body about the issue. But I know we talked about last time that I do think a lot of progressive people mess up when they talk about the issue with people that disagree with them, because they end up making their theology and relationships about identity politics.
Right.
And for me, the Sojourners thing really kind of hit that button, because when I know of all my conservative evangelical friends or people that just aren't card-carrying progressives, Jim Wallis and Sojourners has a voice and a place to speak that I don't have because of being kind of vocal about being open and affirming.
Right.
And to me, tell me if this – maybe you're nice, so you would tell me if this is really, really, like, mean – to me, I think like when liberals get really excited and they want you to accept some new identity into the structure of accepted particular types of humans. So like, you know, conservatives, maybe it's just male and female, single, regretfully divorced, and married or something, or child. But there are all these kind of different particular types of persons, and they get accepting the general accepted structure of humans. And then progressives start accepting more. So we have gay people because they're born that way, or lesbians, and then maybe transgendered, and then and slowly we've added on a whole list of letters in the alphabet.
There's a lot of letters to remember. Yeah. The problem I see, and I feel myself, is that it's like if you don't have the right opinion about this, you know, in one area, then you're out. Like, which really... I mean, like I was saying before, I mean, I'm familiar with fundamentalism from sort of the right, but sometimes, you know, people on the left can be fundamentalists too. And I do think it's problematic when you say, well, you have nothing left to offer because you don't fall in line here. Mm-hmm. You know, and I mean, I really can see both sides of this. I see, you know, it wasn't like it was their opinion. It's just an ad, like, you know. Yeah. It's a big deal. But then on the other hand, you don't want to alienate people. And then I also think about, you know, but for gays and lesbians, this probably feels like, you know, I don't know, just another way to marginalize them. And, mm-hmm. and so, I mean, I really can see it from all angles, but what's worrying to me as somebody who would really like to be more vocal as I personally try and mm-hmm. navigate this issue is that it's just a confirmation of the fact that no matter what I say, I'm going to get nailed on both sides and I'm going to get stuck in a category and I'll never be able to get out. And so I know a lot of people who are in this position where they feel like they have to avoid it because they have to have their mind totally made up and they have to come down one way or the other, or they're out with somebody, you know, somebody's going to be mad. And I think we should be brave and we should say what we think. And I'm the kind of person who usually is very vocal about what I'm struggling with and what I'm working through. But on this issue, I have learned, you know, like, I'm afraid I'm going to have to wait until I have it all figured out because, you know, like, I'll be stuck, whatever I say, you know, I'll be stuck there. And I think a lot of people feel in that position. And so the tragedy is that they're not able to work through it together, because whatever you say can land you, you can lose your job or you could lose your friendships or your readership or whatever it may be for simply not fitting into a category, you know? And that's what troubles me about the whole, just the reaction was so strong. I was like, oh boy, well, I mean, I wouldn't tell my progressive friends that I have these thoughts and I won't tell my conservative friends that I have these thoughts. So I just, you can't. You'll get shut out of the conversation. And so you just have to, it's too bad. I think a lot of people are kind of struggling through this silently.
Yes, like you're allowed to believe out loud, no matter what your opinion is, if you have it, but you can't think out loud.
Yeah, you can't.
Because it will be held against you in the court of the biblioblogosphere.
That's true.
Yeah, and publishers such.
Right.
And I know tons of people have published books their publishers would not have published if they were open about what they think. And that to me is just really sad.
It is, really is. Either way, and another thing on the other side of it, people, and I, most of my friends and family are not, you know, open and affirming.
Right.
And that's one thing that they're not all homophobes either. Do you see what I mean? Like,
right.
There's such a scale. There's a scale, a sliding scale when it comes to sexuality, and there's a sliding scale when it comes to people's approaches to human sexuality. And so, you know, like, not, I don't know. everybody doesn't fit into these categories. Mm-hmm. So sometimes you get the sense from the more progressive side that if you have any reticence on this or any questions, or, you know, if you really want to understand or you know, stick to your interpretation of the Bible on this issue, that you must therefore, you know, hate gay people. And that is just not true. No, I know a lot of people who are, they believe that homosexuality is a sin, and they're very good, loving people who don't hate gay people. Now, right. I, you know, whether or not you agree with that, and whether or not you think that's the right conclusion, it's just like anytime you start guessing on motives, it's just, and there are homophobes out there too, believe me. I've encountered those as well, where they're just using the Bible to sort of support their hate. But then there are people who just really feel, you know, convicted that this is, you know, this is what they believe, and they're not all hateful. So it's just, we just have to be careful about making any stereotypes one way or the other. It's just easier if we fit into these categories, but we just don't.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. No, I understand. I think that's why my biggest issue is how much of distraction this is. And when the Believe Out Loud campaign is a challenge not to conservatives or not to people who are questioning, it's a challenge to those of us who are progressives, who are welcoming and embracing of people no matter where they are in their understanding of their sexual identity, gender identifications. We want them to be welcomed at our church and get challenged to take the next step in their relationship with God, just like everyone does when dealing with their sexuality. All we're doing is fighting for people to be accepted in the world as it already is, and not being prophetic about what actually changes the material lives of people and future generations who are going to have to live with our ecological decisions we've made.
Are people saying they're not going to subscribe or what? I mean,
yeah, I mean, there's all kinds of things.
Like, consequences?
Liberals like protesting, like online and with their wallets, and Twitter makes it easy. And I mean, I for as many things that so many of my friends say they're going to throw a hissy fit about and change their mind about and all that kind of stuff, little happens like in the long term. And I think I hope that we recognize as progressives how big an ally Sojourners is when it goes to the poor and the planet. And they aren't saying anything against this other issue. But if they're going to help us live out loud about caring for the poor and the planet and be our advocates in Washington and that kind of thing, and give thoughtful theological reasons for people of all parts of Christendom to care about these kind of issues, then I would hope that when tempers cool, we can still support Sojourners. But you know, I really have friends with that one issue about sexuality. If you don't answer correctly, and this goes for people on left and right, they're done.
It's so true. That's
it. I really don't even know what issue that would be for me.
If you're the kind of reactive person who it's like, I can't be a part of this, it's just, you're going to end up being very isolated, because we just, the fact of the matter is we have to work with people we don't agree with. I mean, that's just it, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, a really big tent, frankly, has to include people who are not affirming. I know that that's hard, and I get why that's hard. I really do. I get why that's hard. Well, no, I can't ever totally understand how hard that must be for some people, but I mean, I just, otherwise, how are any of us going to learn from anybody? How can we, I don't know. Yeah. I'm tired of these litmus tests. I get them from the, you know, fundamentalists on the right, and I get them from the fundamentalists on the left. And the fundamentalists on the left want to know how I feel about gays and lesbians, as do the people on the right. People on the right want to know how old I think the earth is. They want to know, you know, do you believe in inerrancy? There's all these litmus tests. And sometimes I'll get emails from people that are just 10 questions. And it's just, it's predictable. Inerrancy, homosexuality, evolution, it's just feminism, all these things. And they just, I can just tell they're just testing me. But you know, I get that list all the time. And it's just, you know, you just get real tired. And so when people from the left start doing the same thing, it's just like, I start to get this real burned out feeling like, Oh, great. Here we go. I thought I had found sort of a safe place for me to at least express some of my thoughts. And now they want to know. Now they're issuing me a litmus test, too. You know, and how did you vote? You know, do you recycle?
Well, yesterday seems so far from me now. I've got to close my eyes to see.
Do you have a preference of which S you're about to get?
I don't.
Well then, okay, I was touching on scripture, so why don't you tell me?
Oh, scripture.
Yes.
All right. Yeah, I was going to say, I said this earlier, that I think scripture is sort of where the next big conversation's going, especially with evangelicals. Because that's one of the reasons I'm doing my year of biblical womanhood, is I really wanted to get into this whole notion of using the Bible as an adjective, you know, prescriptively, like biblical womanhood, biblical politics, biblical economics. It's an interesting phenomenon to me. And obviously it's got its issues because technically speaking, it's biblical for a woman to be sold by her father to pay off debt. I think the big conversation is going to be, how do we interpret and apply the Bible? What is the Bible meant to be? What do we do with this word inerrancy? Is it helpful? Because so many conversations just end when somebody says, well, I hold this position because I believe the Bible. Clearly you don't. You know, yeah. It's just, oh. And a lot of us are getting tired of that, and we want to see it move a different direction. But some of the old guard don't. So I really think scripture is where the next big conversation is going to be. Like, I mean, I think the whole Rob Bell thing with heaven and hell is kind of where the conversation is now. But if we get down to the bottom of that conversation, there's this underlying, well, the reason we disagree with Rob Bell is because we believe the Bible.
Oh, clearly.
You see what I mean? So we need to talk about what that means to believe the Bible. And I'm still trying to figure it out. And even amidst the year of biblical womanhood, covering my head and all this, I still haven't really, you know, figured out exactly how to articulate how my relationship with the Bible, it sounds kind of weird, has changed. But I'm working on it.
Yeah, I have a theory that mainline Protestants, a lot of them, should just start reading it again. Here's one of the things I find crazy about the conversation is in Rob's book, in all the freakouts about it, he was saying this salvation is about God. It's not about us. And I really think that is what the gospel's about. That the gospel is about who God is and what God is doing in the world for the world, no matter in what way you want to speak finally
about. Part of me just wonders, can anybody really know any of this for sure anyway? So why? I mean, I think it's good to follow these thoughts to their conclusions and to try and, you know, sort of, I don't know, imagine this future. But at the same time, can any of us really know? I mean, we know what God's character is, but can we really know exactly what that's going to look like?
Yeah, you know, but the salvation, how we understand it, says a lot about who God is, which then says a lot about who we're called to be.
I will say that there, at some level, there is such a thing as a slippery slope, because it is true that once you start asking questions about sort of your paradigm, your religious paradigm, what you've grown up with, what you've always been taught, when you start asking one question, there it's very likely that that will lead to other questions. So I try not to tell people that the slippery slope is completely invented, because there is a level of truth to that. And, you know, it's scary and it's new and it's uncomfortable, but I think it's important to go ahead and slide down. You can quote me on that. Rachel says, slide down the slippery slope, because, you know, sort of on your way down, I mean, that's where you really, what is essential to your faith gets tested, and you end up asking those really important questions, like, why am I a follower of Jesus to begin with? Mm-hmm. You know, it's sort of, you have to kind of strip all that extra away to get to that question. And so the slippery slope at some level is real, but often it's communicated that, you know, if you start asking one question, you're going to leave the faith. Whereas, you know, for me, it wasn't that I didn't leave my faith, my faith just changed. And so what I was sort of exposed to, and, you know, not so much from my parents, but from my culture growing up, was like, if you believe that evolution is the best explanation for how things came to be, you will lose your faith. If you don't interpret certain passages of the Bible literally, you lose your faith. If you are welcoming of gays and lesbians, you're not really a Christian. And so it's sort of like everything gets bundled together and you can't take one thing out or else everything will explode.
Yeah.
So that's something that I've really committed to, you know, investigating and picking apart, because I think that's a really dangerous thing that people are told. And a lot of my friends believed it and left the faith. So it's kind of ironic that a lot of these, you know, pastors and leaders are actually contributing to their own sort of demise by saying, you know, you have to choose. Even Al Mohler says, you know, the gospel of Jesus Christ is incompatible with evolution. You cannot accept both. It's like when you create that dichotomy, people will believe you and they'll leave the faith, you know, because they can't reconcile it with their intellectual integrity. So on the one hand, I want to be honest about the fact that, yep, when you start asking questions, you're going to ask more. But on the other hand, I want to be honest about how asking questions doesn't mean you're going to lose your faith.
Right.
Always think about perfect love casts out fear. And so if it's fear that's keeping you from asking questions, that to me is like the, like I said in my book, the kind of doubt that leads to despair is not, doesn't start when you know, begin asking God questions, but when out of fear, you stop asking questions.
Yeah.
So if fear is the motivation behind not dealing with those sort of in the back of your mind questions, that to me is the worst kind of faith of all. It's despair.
That is the perfect place to get out of the time machine. I think you hear right there the kind of love and thoughtfulness that made Rachel so compelling to so many people. Someone who I continue to miss. And as you'll hear at the end of this episode, someone that Nadia misses as well. As we head into the ad break, I just want to remind you all that you can support what's going on here at the Emerged Podcast. Head to emergedpodcast.com. And for as little as 10 bucks total, you can become a member and get access to all sorts of bonuses, unedited interviews, including all three of the Rat episodes and more. So thank you so much for all the supporters and all of you for listening and sharing. And we'll be right back with Tony and Ryan. Hey friends, if you want to hang out with us, then consider coming to Theology Beer Camp this October in Denver, Colorado. You'll not just get to hang out with us, there'll be 20 or so different podcasts, there'll be 20 or so different scholars, theologians, biblical scholars and such, and there'll be hundreds and hundreds of people who like asking big questions and aren't sure where, how together to do it. If you want to be a part of that, come taste the fun and delicious craft beverages. Come to camp. TheologyBeer.camp. Check it out, and we'll see you there.
In The God of Wild Places, Tony Jones opens up for the first time about what pushed him out of the church and into the woods. And he explores the spiritual insights he's gained in wild places about place and peace, about risk and failure, about predators and death. Brian McLaren says, "I love this book. I love its honesty, its tenderness, its craft, its settings, its quests and questions, and the profound mysteries toward which it bows. It takes you places you need to go." The God of Wild Places by Tony Jones is available wherever books are sold.
Welcome back to Emerged. We are now going to turn to a conversation I had with Ryan Burge. Ryan is a professor, a political scientist, a demographer, a Substacker, and a guy who puts together graphs. many, many graphs. He's written several books, including The Nuns. He is well regarded, I think, as the leading expert on the nuns. That is, Americans who have no religious affiliation, which is, as you all probably know, the fastest growing group on the American religious landscape. He teaches at Eastern Illinois University and is actually, he and I are working on a project together doing the largest ever survey of American nuns that will come out later this year. Ryan is a regular podcast guest on Homebrewed Christianity and other podcasts. And like I said, his Substack is super popular because he really, as you'll hear, has a sense of what's going on in the religious landscape in America. And because of that, we turn to him for his expert advice on what in the world has changed since 2011, which, frankly, it seems like everything has changed. So here's the beginning of my conversation with Ryan Burge.
It felt like 2011 might as well have been 1911 at some level, right? Like, it just felt like a different world. For someone who follows like the religious discourse as well as I possibly can online, it just felt like this conversation is so quaint compared to the conversations that we're having now. And, you know, part of that is, Rachel, this is 2011, right? Like, Mitt Romney was the standard bearer for the GOP. Obama was not even, you know, hasn't run for re-election yet. Like, it's a different world in 2011. You're seeing the first fruits of, like, the schism that's going to widen over the next 12 or 13 years. But Rachel is struggling with, like, I don't want to pick a side. I don't want to be totally in one lane. But I think she felt like she was going to have to pick a lane. That was not the moment, but it was, you know, it was in the near future. She was going to have to figure out what she was and how she was going to position her brand, to use, you know, those kind of languages.
That's so interesting you use that kind of language, because that's exactly the first question I really want to ask you about, is specifically about how quaint it seems now that Jim Wallace in 2011 and Sojourners, they were also trying to have it both ways. So they were, I mean, Tripp and Rachel talk in that interview about Sojourners refusing to put an ad in their magazine for a clergy group that was kind of pro-gay equality. It's interesting. I looked it up. It wasn't until 2 years later in 2013 that Jim Wallace officially changed his position and said that he was gay affirming. And now we might look back 10 years later and be like, Jim Wallace has always been gay affirming. But it's not the case. So I wonder if you can track us on the changes in attitudes among Christians towards GLBT issues.
It's wild to think in 2004, there were over a dozen states that put a ballot initiative on the ballot to make sure that marriage between one man and one woman passed in every single state, including Oregon. Okay. And by significant numbers, too, not like 1 point or 2 points, like 7, 8, 10 points. I mean, and that was less than 20 years ago. So, you know, we have moved so dramatically on LGBTQ issues. And I think that, you know, 2011 was this weird inflection point where it's like not quite, but almost there on the move. You got to remember, when Obama ran for president in 2008, he was not in favor of same-sex marriage. Biden's actually the one who came out in favor of same-sex marriage first and then forced Obama to basically follow his lead. Although I think we all know that Jim Wallace and Barack Obama and Joe Biden were all in favor of at least civil unions, you know, back in those days, but were worried that the public wasn't where, I think a lot of it was, no, you go first. And I think Rachel was very much in the mode of like, I don't want to be the first one on this issue. I need some other people to move all at once, and I'll move with them. So I'm not standing in front of the crowd with everyone throwing rocks at me. They're throwing rocks at all of us, and we're not going to get hit by that many rocks.
One of the things Sojourners, I think, was trying to do, and they were not alone in this, because I remember back in those days, like, going to the National Youth Workers Convention by Youth Specialties. There were years when, like, Ralph Reed and Tony Campolo were both keynote speakers. So these were big evangelical organizations that were trying to appeal to mainliners and to evangelicals. So what happened between 2011 and now? Are there even organizations that try to do that anymore?
I think it's the backdrop of all this is that same-sex marriage did not reach majority popularity until around 2012, 2013. So, you know, again, we're not there yet. But then even today, it's like it's close to 70% now. The general public is in favor of same-sex marriage. Amongst young evangelicals, 18 to 35, it just got above majority status in the last 2 or 3 years. And I think this is what Rachel, and I do this too, and I think you do this too. You think about like who my audience is. And do I make a stand on principle or do I make a stand on what will keep my audience happy? And I don't care who you are. I know it sounds idealistic. I will always stand on principle. But guys like Jim Wallace were probably thinking, I can't, my base is a certain kind of person. Rachel was thinking my base is a certain kind of person. And here's what broke the dam, I think. Social contact theory is the idea that if you know someone of an outgroup, makes you more tolerant of that group. So as more people came out as gay, it was easy to be anti-same-sex marriage when you did not know anyone who was personally in a same-sex relationship. But then the tide turned very quickly because as one person came out, that gave permission to 3 more people to come out, and then 3 more, and then 10 more, and then 12 more. And then it became an issue where it's like, it's not just some random person in San Francisco, right? It's my uncle or my aunt or my sister or someone I went to high school with. I think they're a good person and they deserve the right to get married. So I think that wave was like was getting ready to crest in 2011, and then it crested. And I think Rachel would be in a totally different spot now. If she survived, she would have been much more outspoken on these issues because the tide turned, the public changed on this issue.
You are gonna change your mind someday. Just let go of all your thoughts.
Rachel had a great position. She was not scary to evangelicals, especially moderate or maybe even like slightly right of center. Evangelicals were not afraid of reading a Rachel Held Evans book like they would be afraid of reading a Nadia Bowles Weber book or a Diana Butler Bass book. Those two women were coded as very liberal. Rachel was coded as still trying to struggle with evangelicalism. And I think that's why her audience was so big, because she still picked up most of the left. She didn't make anyone mad for not being liberal enough, but she also was able to speak into some of the evangelical audience, which from a numeric perspective is a heck of a lot bigger than the mainline audience, the mainline female audience. You don't see many people like that in American life anymore. And I wonder if it's a product of the polarization we're going through, or it's a product of how adept Rachel was at sort of walking through those landmines and not tipping one way too much or the other way too much.
So you're saying Rachel would have probably stayed within evangelicalism like Beth Moore.
In my, you know what's funny? In my head when I was just talking, I was thinking Beth Moore was the first person I came to mind. Like, to me, she's the closest corollary to what Rachel did.
Okay, so explain to listeners what happened to Beth Moore in the time since 2011 when Rachel was having this conversation.
So Beth Moore was without a doubt the most popular female Bible teacher of my lifetime. Like, there's no one even close. Maybe Joyce Meyer, but she's got this weird, like, charismatic niche that's not that big. Beth Moore was the leading female voice in Southern Baptist Convention, wrote for Lifeway, had a huge contract, I mean, sold literature and curriculums, did these speaking events. And then when Trump happened, she basically came out publicly and said that I can't support that candidate, and basically that evangelicalism has become toxic and I can't deal with it anymore. So she left the Southern Baptist Convention. She left Lifeway and actually signed with a non-evangelical publisher and has now joined an Anglican church, which is still right of center, I think theologically and politically, but is not Southern Baptist. And she's been almost cast as a pariah now by the evangelicals who like to crow about things on social media.
Pastors have always been political. They've always voted, and people take positions. But I ask Ryan, what has changed so dramatically since 2011 till 2024?
COVID was the worst possible thing to happen to American religion for a bunch of reasons, but one is it forced pastors to pick a political side. Do we mask or do we not? Do we distance or do we not? For a long time, pastors would just sidestep all that nonsense. But with COVID, you had to make a choice. And I think for a lot of people, it goes, okay, I know where you are now. I know who you vote for. I know what your politics are. You've been hiding them for all this time. And now I know because you wore a mask. So I think you could only dodge bullets for so long. You know, like even Neo with that thing, right? He dodged a bunch of them, but one caught him. eventually one's going to catch you. And I think Rachel would have been caught by, you're not conservative enough for us from the evangelical crowd. And it would have pushed her even further to the left. Maybe not by her own design, but just by the way the discourse goes. I think Trump was like this like Red Sea moment. Like either you're with us or you're against us. If you actually look at the data, the people who left religion the quickest during the Trump administration were people born between 1975 and 1985 who identified as Democrats. The share who never attended church jumped like 10 points in 4 years amongst that specific cohort, which, by the way, is Rachel's cohort and my cohort. Rachel and I would have went to, we would have been the same class in high school. We were born like 6 months apart. We were the ones who grew up when evangelicalism was at its numerical peak. It peaked in 1993 and still kind of rode that wave throughout the late 1990s. I think culturally that's when evangelicalism was as strong as it's ever going to be, is like between 1991 and 2002 or so. And that's exactly the culture that Rachel was immersed in, like I was immersed in. And I think for a lot of people, Beth Moore included, go back to Beth Moore, the Trump thing was like, okay, now this is a bridge too far. You've pushed us one step farther than we're willing to go. And I think that's where a lot of people went from being evangelical adjacent or evangelical sympathetic to ex-evangelical, anti-evangelical, mainline, something that's not sympathetic to the evangelical cause because Trump was such a caustic figure. And I don't – listen, Rachel could not have seen that coming in 2011. That's an important point. You know, no one could have seen what's coming in 26. Think about this. The last person the Republican Party nominated for president that was not named Donald Trump was named Mitt Romney. There's no way you could have seen what was going to happen. And so I think Rachel would have had a harder time, right, trying to navigate that landscape. I think the key for her was she was always willing to speak into evangelicalism and try to speak to those people in a respectful way that other commentators were not willing to do. That's easy to do when they're 2 clicks away from you. It's impossible to do when they're 8 clicks away from you. And I think that's what's happened in the 13 years since that interview was recorded. What's funny is I actually think in some ways the emergent church movement, it forced evangelicalism to like look at itself in a more significant way and get more reticent about what it believed about things like ultimate truth and right and wrong and good and evil and all those things. If you want to see like the Freedom Caucus, the precursor to that was the Tea Party. If you want to look at like the ex-evangelical movement, I think the precursor to that was the emergent church movement in a lot of ways. If you want to talk about the resurgence of the young mainline, it's not in the data, but you kind of do see it online. Some people are, you know, younger people are going into the mainline church. I think the seeds of that were planted with emergent Christianity. Now, for a lot of people, it didn't take, it feels like it did for the Republican Party. Like the Freedom Caucus took, like they exist and they're growing and they're angry and all those things. I was at a talk yesterday, actually. Someone mentioned Phyllis Tickle and the idea that every 500 years that religion has this like major revolution.
But every 500 years, the Latinized culture goes through a huge upheaval.
And obviously the last one's the Protestant Reformation. And we're 500 years out now from the Protestant Reformation. So what was the emergent church movement part of that schism? I don't know. Like, I think it's too early to tell, but I do think the emergent church was like sort of part of that conversation in the beginning to like crack American Christianity up a little bit. But the other problem is, and this is what I said at the meeting, I go, here's the other thing I don't think the Reformation was different because now 30% of Americans are non-religious and 45% of Gen Z are non-religious. So how do you reform a religion when half of Americans are like, I don't care about that at all? That's the other thing too, talking about Rachel Hallett Evans. In 2011, the nuns were like 12% of America. Now they're 30% of America. You know, would she have been able to tap into some of those nuns and bring them into the mainstream? You know, or keep them in the fold for longer? I don't know the answer to that question, but that's a market that she didn't have to really address because it didn't really exist in numbers like it exists today.
Finally, and this is pure speculation, but I asked Ryan, as somebody who observes American Christianity, where he thinks Rachel might be if she were still alive today.
I think she would have been huge on Substack.
Yes.
You and I talked about that last week. Like, I if you look at like the top Substacks in the religion category, three of the top six are Nadia Bowles Weber, Diana Butler Bass, and Sarah Bessie, which are both, all three left of center female Christian authors in the religion category. I think she would have been either number one or number two. Number one, by the way, is a Pentecostal prophecy blog that like 100,000 people read, which is fun. I don't think she would have got to that level, but I think she would be bigger than all those people I just mentioned because she was able to pick up all the people on the left, but also some of the people in the middle and the right. I think she would have had broader appeal than anyone else for a couple reasons. One is because she had evangelical bona fides, right? She grew up in an evangelical church, you know, at a time when evangelicalism was thriving. Went to Bryan College, for goodness sakes. Her parents were super evangelical. She still lived in Tennessee, you know, so she wasn't like choosing to move out to one of the coasts or a blue state. She was still very much in that culture in many ways, and she engaged it. I think if you read her stuff, she doesn't engage evangelicalism to mock it, but try to understand it in a more complete way. Like the book on biblical womanhood was actually a really smart book because it took the Bible seriously. And I think that's what evangelicals appreciated about her was she really did try to read the Bible and understand it the way an evangelical would understand it, but also bring in another perspective at the same time. So she wasn't always your opponent. I do think that Rachel specifically probably kept a lot of younger people in the fold for longer than they would have been without Rachel. I don't want to say that like she kept millions of people in Christianity who were going to leave by her writing. Like I don't think that's true. I think a lot of people were sort of falling down the rope, the greasy rope, and getting towards the bottom. And she kind of gave him a hand and held him up for a while and said, no, 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 don't go all the way down there yet. There's still something here for you. I do wonder if the rope got greasier at the bottom because of Donald Trump and the Freedom Caucus and the far right wing and all those things. Like, I don't care how strong Rachel's arms are, you're still sliding down the rope. And she didn't have enough arms to hold everybody up from sliding down the rope. So I think, if anything, I think it forestalled what was already happening in the culture and maybe delayed the rise of the nuns just a little bit amongst a certain subsegment of the population. You know, you could only do so much in your little world. You know, there's that old story like, you know, a kid's walking on the beach and there's all these starfish there and there's thousands of them. He throws one back in and another back in and someone says, do you think it really matters? And he goes, well, it mattered to that starfish. I think that's what Rachel was doing, right? He's trying to throw starfish back in the ocean, but more starfish were washing up on the shores every single day. You know, the macro level emergent church, I put in the same category, right? They tried to hold people into evangelicalism or in Christianity as long as they could. It might have kept a few people back in the ocean, you know, that didn't wash back up on shore, but I think the vast, vast majority left and won't come back.
Now we're going into my conversation with Nadia Boltz-Weber. And I asked her about her memories from the first time she met Rachel Held Evans at Big Tent Christianity in early 2011.
We'd read each other's stuff. I think I'd read maybe one or two blog posts of her. I didn't even really know who she was. I didn't. And she was so kind of shy and, you know, hadn't done a ton of public speaking, but she was so brilliant that as soon as she got off stage, I went up to her and I was like, these are the first words I said to Rachel Held Evans. I said, girl, you're smart as fuck. That's the first thing I said to her. I was not wrong. And I just, she was so brilliant. And our friendship just kind of started there, and we would kind of read each other's stuff and we kept in touch. And then we actually remember there was a Wild Goose Festival West one year. I don't know. Were you there?
Oh yeah, we did the podcast live at that little in the round thing from like 10 to midnight every night.
Yeah. Well,
that was where Rachel was on that one was right after she'd gotten in trouble for putting the word vagina in her book.
Yeah, and, Vagina Gate. Yeah, yeah, that's right. We shared a bed. We got a house, and it was me and her and Richard Rohr and Bishop Flunder. And we shared this little house together, and but Rachel and I had to actually share a queen size bed. But I think there was this feeling between us of we would just always be on each other's side. Our culture can kind of pit women against each other, like we're each other's competition. And Rachel and I just sort of quietly rejected that when it came to each other and just tried to support each other as much as we could. So,
Rachel touched a whole bunch of people's lives, and many of us mourned her loss. And so I asked Nadia, one of her dearest friends and partners, about her experience and grief in losing Rachel.
It was a huge hit for us as a sort of progressive Christians in America when she died. You know, we ran a conference together for 5 years that was, you know, lifting up the voices of other women. I think it was, in a way, we tried to take the thing in our friendship and make it bigger in the sense of, I asked her, I said, what should we do with the fact that everyone seems to be listening to us right now? And I said, I feel like the most honorable thing is to leverage that to get them to listen to other women. So that's what we did in that conference. And the last one we did was in San Francisco, and she went home and texted me, and she goes, oh, I think I caught something while I was there. You know, I'm not feeling well at all, so I just crashed, you know. And then she's like, I'm just not getting better. And then she was in a coma. You know, it was just so sudden. She was still nursing a baby. I mean, it was just, and Dan called and said, he called me and Sarah Bessie and Jeff Chu and said, if you want to say bye, you should come get on a plane right now. So we were there when the night Rachel died, and then the three of us were kind of bonded from that, and then planned her funeral. The outpouring of people in terms of the impact that she had, I mean, the permission she gave people was immense. She was such a gentle, prophetic, beautiful permission giver for people who just needed some permission, you know, in their deconstruction, without it being maybe quite so angry or hostile. You know, it was a little more gentle. Yeah. I loved her.
When you think about your friendship, is there a particular story or two that comes to mind quickly when you start to reminisce or someone brings her up that you think kind of captures who she was past or beyond, or like behind the public persona that both of you kind of, that mantle both of you tried to figure out what to do with?
Well, I always love that she would constantly say, she would constantly say to other people, you know, if I met her and if I met Nadia in high school, she would have scared the living Jesus out of me. So we were just like unlikely friends in a way. I mentioned this at her funeral, that every time she'd answer the phone, she'd answer it in a really particular way when I'd call. She'd go, Nadia. Like every time it would ring, she'd go, Nadia. And it was so, I don't know, it was just her, you know, her heart. It was incredible that so much brain and so much heart got to be in one person. You know, a lot of people are kind of more one than the other, but she wasn't.
Emerged is a homebrewed Christianity production. Trip Fuller and Tony Jones are your hosts. Production, mixing, and sound design by Josh Gilbert. Media and marketing by David Trotter. The music you're hearing is from the Cobalt Season, thanks to Ryan Sharp. Other music used is from Solomon's Porch, thanks to Ben Johnson. Thanks to all our Emerged members who make the show possible. And thanks to you for listening. See you next time.